2020 doesn't seem so far away anymore. As election time nears, a look at Texas's political landscape and priorities today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown, breaking down the effects of a rollback of rule changes put in place to prevent another deadly explosion like the one in West Texas. Plus, appropriate for this week, what do we have to be thankful for in the energy industry, at least from one perspective? We'll introduce you to an odd couple, an avid hunter and a vegan, and the tiny creatures in East Texas showing the big impacts of climate change. Those stories and more just after this on the Texas Standard. The traffic was a little lighter on the way into work in the Texas capital city. Perhaps we're catching you already on your way to holiday fun. No matter where you are, perhaps at work, like us, we're glad to have you here for the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown, and it is Monday, November 25th. The 2020 elections have felt far away for a long time, but now that we're in late November and the holiday decorations have begun to emerge, it's clear the new year is imminent. There's been speculation for months, heck, since at least the day after Election Day in 2018, about what the Texas electorate will look like in 2020. Will it be blue, purple, maybe just a little less red? Texas Tribune executive editor and co-founder Ross Ramsey writes, the middle is an intriguing but uncrowded place in Texas politics. Ross, thanks for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios.
Thank you for having me.
So if the middle is so lonely, why are people like former Texas House Speaker Joe Strauss waiting that way?
You know, Texas has been a reliably Republican state for so long that people in statewide politics in particular have gotten into the habit of calibrating their campaigns just for Republican primaries. Mm. You win the Republican primary in March, and that's tantamount to winning. The Democrats can't put a campaign together that'll win a statewide election. And the 2018 elections were close enough at enough levels, from the Ted Cruz, Beto O'Rourke race, you know, down through the statewide candidates. 12 Democrats won Republican House seats in the Texas House. So it was a big year, and the Republicans are looking up and going, there may be competition in November. Maybe we should move a little bit to the left.
Hmm.
And the first stop on your way to the left is the middle.
So they're not thinking that 2018 was just an anomaly, just the Beto effect then?
They're thinking that it could be. You know, you never know if a state is red or blue until you see the results.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in competition, you want to be in front of that. And so they're running as if the state was already purple or bluish.
And so what are some of these areas that are ripe for moderates? I think you mentioned, or the Texas Tribune has covered, LGBT issues,
right.
Also some gun control. Those, I think, are used to be very divisive issues. Are they gaining more middle ground?
They're super divisive issues. But the question is how you talk about them and who do you think you're talking to?
Hmm.
And in guns in particular, we just did a poll, the University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll in October, and found that the electorate hasn't moved much. The opinions of Texans are about what they were. 51% think that the gun laws are not strict enough in the state, more women than men, which is interesting. We can come back to that. There's a majority in favor of background checks, a majority in favor of red flag laws. There's actually a majority in favor of an assault weapons ban. But then you start looking at that, and if you're talking to just the Republican part of that audience, then you speak in a certain way. They're not for an assault weapons ban.
Hmm.
They're less in favor of some of the other things. If you're talking to a general election group, you have to talk about all of it. I mean, it's a very slight change, but you see Greg Abbott, the Republican governor, talking about red flag laws. You see the very conservative lieutenant governor talking about maybe we should expand background checks a little bit. You start to see changes like that. They're addressing a different audience or a different part of the audience. It's not that the audience's opinion has changed. It's that they're seeing the whole crowd now.
Now, at least on a statewide basis, is this movement only happening on the right? Where are we seeing Democrats moving towards the middle or not so much?
You know, not so much. They're more in a challenger role, and they're, you know, they're going to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And You know, in fact, a number of the Democrats who won Republican seats in 2018 were actually from the progressive end or the liberal end of the Democratic Party. So it's not that they moved to the middle and moderate Republicans came over. It's that they were able to pull out voters who hadn't voted before.
Interesting. Now, there is a national example of this just recently, right? We found out that former Mayor Michael Bloomberg is going to be on the ballot in Texas when it comes to the presidential election. He's generally considered a pretty moderate Democrat.
Yeah, particularly when you look at the Democratic field for president right now, he looks pretty moderate. He's working a weird strategy. He's skipping Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, the early states, and going for the Super Tuesday states like Texas. If you could take Texas out of the Republican column in a national election, it's over. It's the foundation stone for a Republican presidential campaign. So what's more likely here, and what a lot of Democrats are thinking about, is if you can make the Republicans spend money in Texas defending themselves and keeping the state red, that's money they can't spend in swing states.
Well, and it's certainly money that President Trump has been spending visiting Texas, what you wrote, 7 times, I think?
Well, that's actually a sign of this, is that President Trump thinks he needs to be in Texas. He's been here 7 times this year with a recent visit, I guess, last week in Austin. That was 7. He's still got time for one more. But they're defending this. Battle of the New York billionaires is underway.
So Texas, as a we don't know color state, but Republicans are running like they feel challenged by Democrats, at least.
Yeah, the last time the Republicans ran, they won everything. It's still a red state. It looked a lot less red than it has looked in the past. And it was enough of a change to make them nervous.
Ross Ramsey is executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. Ross, thanks again.
Thank you.
If you've been living in Texas for a while, you no doubt remember the deadly fertilizer plant explosion in the small city of West. It killed 15 people and injured hundreds of others in 2013. The Environmental Protection Agency under the Obama administration instituted regulations aimed at preventing another such tragedy. Now the Trump administration has officially reversed them. Matt Dempsey is the Houston Chronicle's data editor. He's been writing about this alongside environmental reporter Perla Treviso. Matt, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So for those who don't remember, did we ever come up with a final cause for the explosion in West?
So the Chemical Safety Board says that no matter how the actual fire that got started that ended up resulting in the explosion, that there was a number of issues that could have prevented the explosion, even if they had a fire. The ATF says that they believe that the fire was started by arson, that it was intentionally set, but there has been no arrests and no updates since they dropped that report.
Well, and it's interesting to ask that question in relation to these regulation rollbacks, because I understand that was part of what was put in place by the Obama administration, at least kind of looking back and asking what happened and why.
Well, the Trump administration specifically cited as one of their reasons that they should be able to roll most of these rules back was that the West explosion, they say, was due to arson, not a failure of regulation. But the Chemical Safety Board, the Obama administration, lots and lots and lots and lots of experts say that that's just not the case. If the fire had been intentionally set, there still would have been lots and lots of ways to prevent this if the regulations were more up to date, according to them.
So were the regulations from the Obama administration ever able to go fully into effect, or have they been facing challenges since the beginning?
Those rules were officially submitted shortly before Obama left office, and they were supposed to phase in over a longer period of time. So there was never a situation where the Obama-era regulations for the risk management plans had ever been fully implemented before the Trump administration, first under Scott Pruitt and now under the newest EPA administrator, started trying to roll it back. So almost as soon as Obama left office and the Trump administration came in, these rules were under attack to, like, let's get rid of these.
So besides delving into what happens or the root causes of an explosion like the one in West, what were these regulations exactly supposed to do?
So they were supposed to hit on a number of issues that the Obama administration, chemical safety experts, and others had found to be gaps or issues with existing regulation. For example, it required companies to do third-party audits after an incident. It was supposed to make it easier for the public to access like what the chemical hazards were at a facility without having to make an appointment with an EPA reading room like you have to do now. It required companies to analyze their facility and find out whether they could benefit from using safer technology or using alternative chemicals than the ones they are using. It required them to do the analysis. It did not require them to change to doing the safer thing. So there was a lot of things here that were supposed to essentially require companies to do more studies and produce more information, but there was very little in here that would require companies to make actual changes to how they operated.
So besides the Trump administration's argument that the West explosion may have been arson, what was their reasoning behind rolling back these regulations?
The Trump administration said that these rules were unnecessary. These regulations were unnecessary. They felt that making it easier for the public to find out what the potential hazards were from a chemical facility were a potential security risk, and that it was just expensive for companies to follow these rules. The Trump administration and the EPA said that getting rid of these regulations would save Americans $88 million a year, which honestly is a really small amount of money for the petrochemical industry. I mean, that would be about an eighth of ExxonMobil's daily revenue.
Matt Dempsey is the Houston Chronicle's data editor. He's been writing about this alongside environmental reporter Perla Treviso. Matt, thank you again.
Thank you.
And let's get our Monday going off right with a check-in with social media editor Wells Dunbar.
Hi, Laura. The Defense Department has pushed out the Navy's top civilian leader after he publicly disagreed with President Trump's intervention in the case of a Navy SEAL accused of war crimes. We've been talking about this issue some lately. The extraordinary move coming after Trump objected to disciplinary plans, announcing his displeasure where else but on Twitter, writing on part, quote, "I was not pleased with the way that the Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher's trial was handled by the Navy. Gallagher was accused of fatally stabbing a teenage ISIS captive in custody, firing on civilians, and threatening his SEAL teammates if they reported him, although he was acquitted on most of those charges. On our Facebook page, Cindy Horton calls the shakeup in the Navy, she says the shakeup there shows that obeying the law doesn't matter anymore, while Terry Schmidt ponders what effect these interventions might have on chain of command issues. You know, that's just one story that we're eyeing today, Laura. I'll be back with more from social media later in the show.
Yeah, and loosen the head of the Navy there, but wonder if the conversation's really over about this particular issue when it comes to all that stuff. We'll keep watching it, and we'll see you back here in a minute.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. The sound approach to lung cancer prevention is to avoid smoking and tobacco products while working toward a healthy lifestyle. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at TACC.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. A medicine best known as a club drug also has a record of relieving suicidal depression in just hours. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie tells us researchers are now trying to figure out how to make it safer and available to more people.
Back in the 90s, ravers knew it as Special K, ketamine. It's also sometimes called a horse tranquilizer because it's used by veterinarians as an anesthetic. But National Institutes of Health researcher Dr. Carlos Zarate knows ketamine as a potential game changer for people who struggle with treatment-resistant depression and suicidal thoughts. Zarate told those gathered at the UT Health San Antonio Brain Health Symposium on Mood Disorders that ketamine works, and it works quickly when given to depressed people who've tried several different antidepressants and none of them have helped.
One intravenous infusion, they had a response in a couple of hours, which usually takes 6 weeks or longer with a traditional antidepressants.
When given to people having suicidal thoughts, around half of them felt better, also in just a few hours. With suicide rates climbing at an alarming rate among many groups in the U.S., it seems like there'd be a rush to make the drug available everywhere. But right now, you can only get intravenous ketamine infusions or a recently FDA-approved nasal spray in certified clinics. They're not cheap, and insurance might not reimburse you. Zarate says a caution around ketamine centers around its side effects. It can cause confusion and dissociation. There's also a potential for abuse and addiction. But he says years of research finding that, for many, ketamine works and works quickly offers hope.
By better understanding ketamine, reverse engineering, we can develop next generation treatments that are like ketamine, but better tolerated.
The goal? To develop a rapid-acting antidepressant that can be taken by more people with fewer risks. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. The energy industry is, of course, big business here in Texas, and even if your paycheck doesn't come from a company with oil in its name, you certainly are affected in one way or another by its big ups and downs. So, appropriate for this week, we thought we'd talk to our go-to energy expert, Matt Smith, about what to be thankful for in the energy industry. Matt is Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data. Matt, happy Thanksgiving week.
Same to you as well, Laura.
Why don't you go ahead and start us off here? I understand you've come up with at least three big reasons for us to be thankful for the energy industry right now. What is number one?
Okay, sure. So the first one is retail gasoline prices. So on the national average, we are seeing prices ticking lower. But for Texas, they're actually at their lowest since March.
Huh.
So a 6-month low there at $2.23 a gallon. So that's something to be thankful for. It's also, I've got another reason to be thankful, is not to be living in California, because California at the moment, I have got a good reason for this. They've been paying over $4 a gallon recently.
Wow.
Because of refinery outages there. They typically pay more anyway,
yeah.
But they're paying even higher than normal. So, so thank goodness for not living in California, huh?
Wow, that is a big difference. So number two, I guess, has to do with a larger picture of America and the energy industry.
Yes. So what it is the U.S. is becoming a consistent net exporter of crude and products. And so this is for the main reason behind this really is because of rising U.S. oil production. So as that continues to increase, we're seeing imports dropping and we're seeing exports increasing. Mm. So it's a double whammy there. Then you also add in rising propane exports and middle distillate exports and gasoline exports. And all of these things together mean that the U.S. is at an inflection point of becoming a consistent net exporter, something that hasn't happened ever before.
And that's good, I guess, for monetary reasons, economic reasons, but also dependency reasons, people would say.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't mean that the U.S. is becoming energy independent, but it means that it is becoming more of a global player. It is more reliant on its own resources to be able to drive the U.S. economy forward. And so having that control is a good thing.
All right. What about number three, something to do with emissions?
Yes, exactly. So falling carbon emissions. So the EIA, the Energy Department, estimates that energy-related carbon emissions this year will drop versus last year. Now, that is partially due to the weather. So we had a cooler summer than last year, and so we're seeing lower energy consumption. But it is also due to greater use of natural gas and renewables and less consumption of coal as well. But what is actually really interesting on a global basis is that coal consumption is showing a record drop this year. And the areas that are leading that, the European Union, South Korea, but also the U.S. as well.
Wow. It's just surprising and I guess anti-intuitive, because we hear about, you know, the U.S. leaving the Paris Climate Agreement, different things like that. And so it's sort of even despite to those things, just because of progress in the energy industry and I guess with renewables and natural gas especially, it's happened.
Yeah, and so it's not just the altruistic nature of pursuing those renewables, although that is obviously helping things, but it's also the economics as well. So because we're abundant with cheap natural gas, and as renewables become that much more cost effective, we're seeing them pushing out coal as that is somewhat vilified.
So I am an anxious optimist is how I'll describe myself. When things are going too well, I sort of feel that the bottom is going to drop out. So is there anything that's making you anxious right now, or is the horizon pretty clear for continued thankfulness in the energy industry?
The one concern, I suppose, for Texas specifically is with the oil price. And so if we do see oil prices perhaps edging a little bit lower, then that's going to impact people's jobs, etc. So that's the biggest concern, really. But from a production basis, things are good. From a cost basis, they're low for us as end users. And as we saw with the carbon emission side of things, those are coming down as well. So, Laura, I think you're right to be optimistic. I think we're doing okay.
And of course, thankfulness in a way is a matter of perspective. I'm sure there are some who'd like to see, you know, gas prices through the roof to force us to, you know, be better about taking a bus or that sort of thing. But it seems like we're at a good sort of balance point, perhaps.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of a fine line to pursue there. But I think we're kind of managing to balance along the tightrope, it seems.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data. Matt, we are always thankful for you breaking all of this down for us.
And you guys too. Thank you very much.
The cruise ship industry contributed more than $1.5 billion to the Texas economy in 2018. That's the headline in the Houston Chronicle. A new report from Cruise Lines International Association puts Texas only behind Florida and California when it comes to the largest share of the cruise industry in the U.S. Did you know it employs more than 26,000 Texans? And get this, close to 1 million passengers boarded a cruise in Galveston in 2018.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, striving to maintain a tradition of cultivating courageous leaders focused on global impact and innovation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Outgoing Energy Secretary Rick Perry is professing his faith in Donald Trump's presidency as ordained by God. In an interview on Fox News Channel that aired Sunday, the former Texas governor said any shortcomings in the president's leadership or personal life should be judged like those of other flawed biblical figures.
God's used imperfect people all through history. King David wasn't perfect. Saul wasn't perfect. Solomon wasn't perfect. And I actually gave the president a little one-pager on those Old Testament kings about a month ago.
Perry said he also believes former Democratic presidential president Barack Obama was chosen by God to lead the nation as well. The Republican is planning to resign as energy secretary in December. Texas Congressman Will Hurd wants to hear more from witnesses on President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. The Republican from Helotes is a member of the House Intelligence Committee, which wrapped up 2 weeks of public impeachment hearings last Thursday. Hurd says several people should testify still, including the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and former Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter.
We should hear from everybody, right? This is not, and I've said this a billion times, we're not voting somebody off the island in season 12 of Survivor. This is one of the most serious things a member of Congress can do.
Hurd was speaking on the PBS program Firing Line on Saturday. The former CIA officer has condemned Trump's handling of Ukraine, but says he's not convinced the president has committed impeachable offenses. A permanent memorial to the 22 people killed in the August El Paso Walmart shooting is now open. KERA's Mallory Falk was at a Saturday ceremony.
The memorial's in the store's parking lot and made up of 22 aluminum arcs. They join together in the shape of a candle and light up at night. It was unveiled to the public early Saturday morning after a private viewing the night before for victims' families. El Paso Catholic Bishop Mark Seitz offered a prayer in Spanish and English during the dedication.
Grant that the light of this candela might reach deep into the wounded hearts and souls of El Pasoans and all who pass by this sacred place.
The Cielo Vista Walmart reopened earlier this month after extensive renovations. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
The Texas Education Agency will appeal a federal order to pay $200,000 to a former special education director who'd sued for wrongful termination. The U.S. Department of Education is ordering the TEA to compensate Lori Cash, who was fired in 2017, a day after she reported the agency had illegally awarded a no-bid contract. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. In one of the state's most rapidly developing natural areas, a nonprofit group is stepping in to protect environmentally sensitive land. The Nature Conservancy of Texas made the final purchase late last week of 500 acres of natural area along the Blanco River called El Rancho Cima. It's been a recreational piece of land that used to serve as a Boy Scout camp and is a habitat for numerous animal and botanical species. Jeff Francell is the Associate Director of Land Protection for the Nature Conservancy. Jeff, glad to have you here in the Texas Standard Studios.
Thank you.
Tell us about this land that the Nature Conservancy of Texas has purchased in Hays County. Where is it exactly and what's on it now?
The property is on the Comal-Hays County line. So it's in the far western end of Hays County, about 30 minutes from San Marcos to the west. But it's also very close to State Highway 281. And really, that State Highway 281 to I-35 corridor, that's really where all the growth is occurring.
And is that one reason why the Nature Conservancy wanted to buy up this land? Was it at risk of becoming a target or a housing development or something
otherwise? At some point, yes. And that is one of the reasons why we stepped in to protect the property. But we also stepped in because it's got a stretch of the Blanco River, more than a mile, both sides, that's one of the largest stretches on any property in Hays County.
Now, is that one of the rivers that there's not a lot of public access to? And would this land give people public access to this part of nature? Or is the Nature Conservancy going to use this just to conserve nature?
So ultimately, we're hoping that the property becomes part of Hays County's ownership and part of their county park system. We're hoping that Hays County can pay us back for the property over the next few years, and it will become a public park. Public park and preserve with limited access. And by limited access, I mean a reservation system. Maybe 80 people at a time could go down and picnic and enjoy the river.
And so what's the timeline on this? I guess let's start with that partnership that you mentioned with Hays County. I guess they were involved in helping to purchase this land or are going to issue a bond or something in order to make that happen. Is that correct?
So Hays County has some funding available to protect land with the golden cheek warbler, which is an endangered species. This property has substantial golden cheek warbler habitats.
So what's the Nature Conservancy's strategy here? I know you also made another enormous purchase this year along South Padre Island, an area that's to protect nesting grounds for the endangered Kemp's Ridley sea turtle. Do you see yourself as kind of a stopgap measure in between what local entities are able to do to protect their own lands? Or
that's definitely part of it. The Nature Conservancy has identified parts of the state that have a lot of ecological value, South Padre being one of them, the Blanco River being another. And when we have opportunities to partner, like in South Padre, the funding source was from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And so we were able to access those funds, buy that land, and donate it to a national wildlife refuge. Here, same situation. It's pristine, ecologically important property. Hays County has some of the funding, but not all. So we step in and work together.
Now, let me bring up something that folks hearing this might remember just from recent headlines, which is, you know, Texas voters just approved giving money for sporting goods back to, you know, Texas Parks and Wildlife. What's your relationship with them, and how are you working to move things forward?
Great question. I mean, we definitely supported Parks and Wildlife's and their friends' efforts to get that a constitutional amendment passed. And we're really looking forward to seeing the fruits of that, which will be more funding for our state park system. We really are operating with a state park system that was more or less built 20 or 30 years ago. And at the same time, the state's population has doubled. The Nature Conservancy helped in the same way we did with this property, in the same way we did with South Padre Island. We helped Texas Parks and Wildlife acquire a property, a large tract of land west of Fort Worth, about 5,000 acres, that's the Palo Pinto Mountain State Park. Mm. And so they own it, but they heretofore hadn't had enough funds to build campgrounds and roads and the septic system and water system that they'll need to actually have a functioning park. So that sporting goods sales tax increase and guarantee will help them be able to fund the development of that park so the public can actually get in there and enjoy it. Because if you try to go to Pernales Falls or Enchanted Rock or Lost Maples right now, they're full.
Right.
So we just need a few more places for the public to stretch out, and we're happy to help.
Jeff Francell is the Associate Director of Land Protection for the Nature Conservancy. Jeff, thank you again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Some Texas high school students have been diving into the world of soft shells and sliders. And we're not talking seafood or tiny sandwiches. From KERA North Texas, Bill Zeeble reports these students are part of a lab class learning what field work is really like.
It's still warm on this early October Sunday morning in Fort Worth. About a dozen students and researchers gather once again by the Clear Fork branch of the Trinity River, where it intersects with Rogers Road.
We are doing the Trinity River Turtle Survey, which is a research project with my students at Pasco High School. We come out once a month, catch turtles, mark them, measure them, then release them back into the river.
Andrew Brinker teaches AP Science at Pasco High. He got a grant from TCU to pay for the traps, scales, calipers, and other survey supplies. He and his students are learning about the turtles here, from the red-eared slider to the razorback musk. They're also studying how many are here and what they're up to.
But more importantly, we're trying to get students outside actually doing research in science instead of just reading about it or listening to classroom lectures.
Lectures, says Brinker, can be boring. But not this, says Pasco High senior Jake Harper.
I kind of like the natural part of it. I like being outdoors. I'm more of a getting in the river and pulling out the turtles than a measuring them kind of guy. It's not for everyone, but it's just a really cool project.
The class is ready to pull the last of today's four hoop traps from the Trinity's edge.
All right, you ready?
You're up.
Yes!
Oh, there is a snapper?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Now it's time to weigh and measure that awesome, scary snapper. Kai Rendon gets the honor. In this true collegial project, she's an eighth grader, not a Pasco High kid, but she's been doing this for years on her own.
My cousin lives on a pond, and I go over there every other weekend, and I catch turtles.
Kai carefully weighs and measures the snapper. That's after putting a towel over its head so it can't find her finger.
And 15?
Yeah.
And then post?
What is this? 18.9?
Not giant, not small. Brinker's usually the only one to handle snapping turtles because they are always dangerous. But Kai has experience.
You stay away from the half of the shell back in the front because its head can go all the way back there. So mainly you'll usually grab the back two legs You can put your hand right under its back legs, and then you can hold it that way from the plastron.
The plastron is the turtle's underside. An electronic reader, wanted over it, reveals this snapper has no tracking chip, so it gets one injected under the shell, which also gets notched. The spiny softshell, also caught in the net, can't safely hold the chip, so out comes the Inkinator. And she gets tattooed on the soft part of her underside. The buzz around this Trinity River turtle survey is that it's approaching 1,000 turtles caught and released over 2 years. Brinker and his team have also measured pollution in the river, mercury in the turtles, and even the food in their stomachs.
We've already documented Asian clams in the river that they're feeding on, so it's kind of neat and introduced species that these guys are eating. And now we have zebra mussels in Lake Worth, so that's another reason we're waiting to see, you know, do these guys start feeding on them?
So Brinker is now looking, as he and his students put it, at turtle turds. Elsewhere in the country, researchers know some Trinity River turtle species do eat the destructive and wildly invasive zebra mussels. Brinker and his several students recently exercised their own turtle mussels. They presented some of their river research at the Fall Symposium of the Texas Herpetological Society in far west Alpine, Texas. I'm Bill Zeeble in Fort Worth.
There is a segment of our show we've set aside for people to feel safe to confess their deepest thoughts. We call this the whole truth. But sometimes people want to express more than just their thoughts. They want to share their actions or try to explain them. Like why two people with irreconcilable differences, oil and water you might say, would end up mixed up together. This is one such story.
So I am an animal lover, a conservationist, and a vegetarian.
And I am a hunter.
We are a couple who support each other in our positioning. So I was in fifth grade, and I discovered the animal section in our school library. And I took out a book on the rainforest, which I never even knew existed. And I started reading about it, and they were showing photos of the rainforest being destroyed. And so I went to my friends and asked them to bring me their allowance so that we could save the rainforest. They brought in their money, and we sent cash. And I have no idea where it went, but we believe that we were helping save the rainforest. If I ever saw, you know, hunters posing with these big game animal trophies, it broke my heart. Like, how do you kill something so beautiful and sometimes endangered?
I think a defining moment in our relationship is we went to a ranch in South Texas, and I could physically see her skin crawling, and she had no interest in being around any kind of a hunting setting. And through just circumstance, she ended up speaking with the ranch manager, who explained to her that certain animals will not be hunted, the females will not be touched, the hunters will not be allowed to go into a certain area because there's younger males that are still reproducing, and that there were certain animals that life expectancy was X number of years and they were approaching that time, they were no longer reproducing and they could be hunted.
He had studied them, he understood them, he knew how old they were, and there was just a thought that somebody on the other side could love animals as much as I did, but he was managing the population in a way that it could grow and it could thrive and still be a part of the ecosystem without destroying it.
And likewise, on my side as a hunter, the only conservationists I had seen were people in little boats in the North Atlantic trying to stop whalers from hunting whales. And I thought, well, okay, none of that's going on here. Nobody's hurting whales here. And so I didn't really have an appreciation for a broader conservation discussion.
There's a belief that there's one side or the other. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it comes with education of understanding how it all works together.
And I think whether it's an ideology, a political view, or a debate like this one, I don't think you define it with the extremes. What do you think people can learn from us?
I think people can learn that having a difference of opinion actually helps you be more open to the other side of the argument and not just arguing your side, and how the two can work together and grow your own understanding of the topic as a whole.
Absolutely. We don't wear these titles on our sleeve. There are elements of this debate that we have agreed to disagree on, and that can be healthy as well.
I will never be a hunter. I will never kill an animal. I just can't do it.
What's the likelihood that you'll ever be a vegan?
Zero.
And that's the whole truth.
The Whole Truth is a safe space for anyone with a scandalous truth. Tell us a story and we'll keep your name a secret. Reach out, texasstandard@kut.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. You can see the effects of climate change in hotter temperatures, rising sea levels, that sort of thing. But in East Texas, there's another climate change impact that's a little harder to see. It's affecting some tiny creatures most of us don't really think about, but they have a big effect on our drinking water. The Texas Observer's Christopher Collins went with some scientists from the University of Texas Tyler to find out more.
On the bank of the Sabine River in deep East Texas, the hunt is on. We're looking for mussels. No, not those mussels. We're talking about the unassuming, mostly stationary bivalves that call scores of Texas rivers and lakes home. They clean the water by sucking up pollutants. They're also an important food source for fish, birds, and other animals. As this stretch of the Sabine becomes shin deep about 20 minutes north of Tyler, three mussel biologists get out of a narrow metal boat.
You see the movement of the water, the riffles up here? It's shallowing up, there's a lot of rocks. This is where we're gonna find the mussels.
Lance Williams is a professor at the University of Texas at Tyler. He and the other researchers plunge their hands to the river bottom. Almost immediately, they pull up buried treasure. In just 20 minutes, they found a dozen mussel varieties with funny names like
pistol grip, washboard. That's one of those big guys.
Yeah, this is a three-horned wartyback.
After a quick examination of their size and shape, the researchers carefully put the mussels back where they found them. They don't want to be too rough with the specimens, after all. Mussels face a bevy of threats to their natural habitats. Dams, pollutants. They're perhaps the most vulnerable family of creatures in the entire country. About 70% of native freshwater mussels across the country are in danger of extinction. Williams says mussels also face an existential threat, climate change. Back at UT Tyler, Williams and his team are running tests to determine how rising temperatures in rivers and lakes will affect these critters. So far, the future looks bleak.
So these are artificial streams, but this is where we did our climate change experiments.
Inside this small room on campus, there are two large fish tanks. In one of them, researchers raised mussels in 86-degree water, the average temperature of the nearby Natchez River during the summer months. In the other, scientists turned the dial up to 95 degrees, the temperature the river could reach by the year 2050. So how did the mussels fare once they were put in warmer water?
It was 100% mortality.
In layman's terms, they all died.
So it's not going to take much of a temperature increase in the summertime in August during a drought for us to massively kill off freshwater mussels.
But the plight of mussels in East Texas is more than just a sad story of an underappreciated river dweller. Their demise could have real effects on the quality of drinking water here, says Clint Robertson. He's a biologist with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department who's considered the state's leading expert on freshwater mussels.
They're filtering the water, so they're the little water treatment plants of the rivers, essentially.
A mussel bed about the size of two football fields can filter 10 million gallons of water a day. They can remove 10 tons of algae, bacteria, and other undesirables from water sources before they reach human water treatment facilities.
They're actually cleaning the water for you for free.
Just downstream, at the City of Longview's water treatment plant on the Sabine River, It's Sal Pisano's job to catch whatever contaminants the mussels can't hoover up.
These are our clarifiers.
Here, a series of pumps, pipes, and filters remove sediment and chemicals before the water is piped to residents. Pisano says he and his staff test the treated river water daily to ensure its quality. He also keeps a lookout for spills and leaks from nearby petroleum operations.
Sometimes they have an issue. If you get a heavy rain, a lot of times their tanks will overflow or things like that. You know, you'll see a sheen on the river.
Industrial agriculture is also a major polluter of East Texas waterways. For instance, poultry juggernaut Pilgrim's Pride sent 1,700 pounds of nitrogen pollution into waterways every day in 2017, according to a national environmental group. Sanderson Farms is discharging wastewater from its new slaughterhouse, pushing even more pollution into the river. That means more work for Pisano and the city of Longview.
People's health, you know, is involved in this. And if we do something wrong, you can make someone sick.
The increased pollution could be a double whammy for river health, said Josh Banta, one of the other UT mussel researchers. He notes that while mussels can live in water with low levels of contamination,
beyond that range, they can't handle it and they die.
Listing East Texas mussel species under the Endangered Species Act could curb some sources of pollution. That designation would allow the government to limit pollution in what's known as critical habitat. But Tierra Curry says that won't be easy. She's a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. She notes that the Trump administration has made it even more difficult to get freshwater mussels and other threatened animals covered.
They aren't going to designate critical habitat for species that are threatened by climate change. Scientists tell us that up to 1 million species are at risk of extinction right now. It's just the worst possible moment in history to make these changes to the act.
But it's not all doom and gloom. Man-made problems have man-made solutions, after all. We can slow climate change by cutting emissions. We can curb water pollution by limiting pesticides and fertilizers. Curry says planting trees along the banks of streams and rivers could also soak up contaminants and lower water temperatures.
At this point, everything that everyone does matters, so people shouldn't give up. Hope is contagious.
If you want to help these aquatic critters, don't just clam up. Get out there and do something. And if you can, put some muscle into it. For the Texas Observer and the Texas Standard, this is Christopher Collins in Tyler.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And it's that time of the show again where we check back in with social media editor Wells Dunbar. Hey, Wells, welcome back.
Hey, Laura. Good to see you in the host chair there as always. You know, some important news that broke Friday after we left the airwaves. A Bexar County judge has temporarily blocked the start of San Antonio's paid sick leave ordinance. This is a topic we've talked about on the show before. The sick and safe leave ordinance, which would require most private employers to offer paid sick days off, was set to begin on December 1st, but instead the new rule was postponed for the second time, speaking to the controversy there. Unsure just what is next, our friends at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, they report that the judge that put the temporary injunction in place has also ordered a full trial, but has not set a date for one to take place. But as you know, Laura, these sick leave policies are controversial, not just locally, but at the state level as well. Conservative Texas lawmakers have sought to outlaw such ordinances from taking effect, but I believe they were unable to get that one through the legislature this last session. We've also seen, I know Austin was, I believe, the first Texas city to propose these paid sick leaves. I believe it's making its way to the state Supreme Court, if I'm not mistaken there. Well, on social media, we have lots of folks telling us what they think about the paid sick leave ordinances. Christopher Bart says, you can't raise the minimum wage and you can't get paid sick leave. It's almost like there's an intention to keep a boot on the neck of the working poor. And he goes on to say that we all subsidize this anyway with food stamps and medical billing defaults and the drag on the economy that those things create by not having benefits like paid sick leave. Christine Ellis disagrees. She says, sorry, but sick leave is a perk or a benefit of a job. If you want a job that provides sick leave, better yourself and find a better job or look for a job in the same industry that provides it. The city shouldn't be able to mandate what perks companies provide, and sick leave is a perk slash benefit. So again, another one of these sort of instances of, you know, the state disagreeing with these local policies, but even people at the local level disagreeing as well. So one that always we get a lot of comments on this one every time it comes around. It's interesting.
And we'd like to hear what you think. Of course, you know how to let us know. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter. You can send us an old-fashioned email,
texasstandard@kut.org, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.